Hello, welcome again to Sport Unlocked, coming to you again from the World Cup in Qatar. I'm Rob Harris from Sky News by the waterfront here in Doha late at night. Also here in Doha, Tarek Panja from the New York Times. But back in England, keeping an eye on things, Martin Ziegler from the Times.
Yeah, it's not quite as mild here as it is where you guys are by the looks of it. But it's shirt sleeves outside at you're past midnight there, I think, Rob. Quite pleasant.
Yeah, it hasn't been the stifling conditions that maybe some thought. Although, you know, it has been getting hot during the day. We haven't seen the players really wearing there. Tarek, how have you found it in week two here of the World Cup?
Pretty relentless, isn't it? I mean, there's first World Cup with four games a day. And the late finishes, like, you are home in the early hours if you're covering those games. And then to do the work that I guess we've been known to do, those meetings and meeting executives start in the morning, don't they? So it's kind of a full day, but really interesting tournament for all manner of reasons, positive and negative, I guess, Rob.
Yeah, still so many issues around. I mean, on the pitch, I was there for Germany to see their exit twice now, successive World Cups they've gone out in the group stage. So quite a bit of drama on the pitch and still so many questions and such a focus on the silence of some of the FIFA leadership. Is that something you've noticed, Martin, the fact we've not really heard of them?
So Gianni Infantino, I noticed, was at his favourite place of eating this week. The famous or infamous, depending on your size of your wallet, restaurant of Salt Bay, the Turkish steakhouse chef, whatever. He was there in Doha. You guys have been there, I presume. Tarek, can you get the Salt Bay steak and champagne on the New York Times expenses?
No, I haven't tried, but I can highly recommend the 15 Rial Nepali restaurant just behind Mushreb Station. So if you are in Qatar for the next 2 weeks, a lovely veg or non-veg thali is available and refillable. So get to your feed there. But on the point of your man, Salt Bay and his weird salt thing, didn't Gianni Infantino, when he arrived in 2016, tell us this would be a different FIFA, one that is away from the luxury limousines, the five-star hotels and expensive steak, I suppose? To me, Rob, this FIFA seems even more luxurious than the era of Sepp Blatter.
Well, we were there in Cardiff in the first week of his presidency because there was an IFAB meeting after he just managed to win that election. And he talked about going on EasyJet and he was sort of trying to have this sort of man of the people sort of image. But if we fast forward here to the World Cup in Qatar, there he is at Salt Bay, the home of Gold Leaf Steak. He's going all and around the stadiums. He's there meeting world leaders. He's seen with the great and the good. You don't see him actually mixing with any fans. If he's going out at night, he's there going to Salt Bay. Right near there, because that's based at the Sheraton Hotel, is the Saudi fan zone. It's Saudi House, where there's loads of fans mixing. And one of the things they talk about in Qatar is obviously how safe it is. So of all places in the world where the World Cup could be, actually, Gianni Infantino could quite easily mix around with the normal fans quite easily. But we never see him outside of the gilded bubble of FIFA or places like high-end restaurants, do we?
No, and it's a bit of a scene to be seen World Cup. This is the first World Cup where VIP isn't quite enough. This is the VVIP World Cup, isn't it, Rob? You see that even on the road signs here, like a separate entrance for cars with VVIP, separate hospitality for VVIP. And I guess, you know, Gianni, who spent enough time here for people to think he lives here now, he must have got used to, I guess, being a VIP and not mixed with the oi polloi, certainly not with the media. I don't think we've seen him except when he was put on that screen on the Jumbotron in that game between England and Wales.
When everybody booed.
Yeah, they announced his name and there was loud booing across the stadium. And you know, certainly hearing from those actually in and around the vicinity, perhaps it might have taken him a bit by surprise when that happened. But it really shows how he's got this increased name and face recognition from this tournament, probably not for the right reasons at all, even though the tournament itself is seemingly going smoothly.
It certainly happened to Sepp Blatter. He stopped doing these sort of speeches and things like that at World Cups, didn't he? Because I think at the Germany World Cup in 2006, he was roundly booed, and he never wanted to take the chance after that. So it's Gianni Infantino realizing the hard way that the same thing could happen to him.
Well, there has been a focus obviously this week on one of the big issues of the World Cup, that's dogs preparations, which is migrant worker suffering and the death numbers. So for many years we'd obviously heard the number 3 as the number of work-related fatalities on stadiums, but then Hassan Al-Thawadi, the chair of the World Cup organizing committee here, was asked by Piers Morgan about just how many deaths there had been, and he floated a new number, didn't he?
He mentioned the number 400. So we've got 3, as you said, for fatalities on World Cup sites and 37 for people who have died but not from their injuries at World Cup sites. But now there's this 400 number that was doing the rounds after he appeared on that with a popular broadcaster. But then, Martin, very quickly, and this is quite weird from my experience with the Supreme Committee, when you ask for comment, it can take days for them to provide a response, often after a story's been published. But in this case, they were working like the clappers to correct this 400 number and said, actually, if you look at the entire interview and put it into context, he meant 400 in Qatar since 2014. And it just didn't seem, none of this seems to like make sense. It's very hard to confirm any of this. And again, there's this doubt over how many people have died. And these are real people, real lives, and we still have no idea.
Yeah, Hassan Al-Thawadi was specific around the number. It wasn't just around 400. It was something like 412. And Piers Morgan actually pushed him on this and said exactly how many. And he came up with this. And I think even Piers Morgan was taken aback. And that's a huge number. And Hassan Al-Thawadi said, one death's too many. But I'm not surprised they tried to row back on that, because, if you think about it, 412 people dying in World Cup projects, this is like crazy, isn't it? I mean, it's beyond belief.
Well, they did issue a statement saying that the figures refer to national statistics covering a period of 2014 to 2020 for all work-related fatalities, 414 nationwide in Qatar, covering all sectors and nationalities. And they do say that actually on the number of work-related deaths, it is 3 in 37, not work-related deaths on Supreme Committee projects. And they are saying that is something that is documented relating to 8 stadiums and 17 non-competition venues. But I suppose it puts a spotlight on the lack of clarity on the numbers, the fact that this number's emerged when people have been asking for so long about the 6,500 number, yet this number hadn't been offered in response to that.
No, precisely. This is the point, right? The fact that this fellow's gone on this guy's TV program and come out with a number it speaks to the part of the problem for me. There should be a data available on a website like a government agency that you can refer to, and that these things are tallied up without this kind of cloud over every utterance on this subject. They know how many people have died. This is a country that registers this stuff. It shouldn't be that difficult to work this out. And, the Guardian number is that 6,500, and that refers to the number of people who are workers and died in Qatar. And that's a number. My trip from when I went to Nepal, the number from the Nepalese government is from 2010, the year that Qatar got the World Cup, to until today, the number is about just over 2,000 Nepalese workers in Qatar have died of various causes. But again, no one is specifically looking at this in a way that is systematic and explains why and how they died. And until that happens, we're just going to be playing table tennis with these people's lives and these numbers.
One of the issues being, of course, no autopsies are conducted on all the migrant workers who died, so we don't actually know the full situation surrounding their deaths. Many questions over the intense working conditions, the heat contributing to premature deaths, and obviously that issue over some deaths put down as natural causes, but actually were they dying before they should have done? The other big issue around is the protests, obviously LGBT protests around, and one game in particular saw Pitch Invader, and they were taken away. Tarek, you encountered an issue as well yourself around the stadium.
Yeah, this was a bit unfortunate. I went to watch the Qatar-Holland game. I had to cover that, like Qatar's last game at the World Cup. They'd already been eliminated at that point. But I thought it would still be interesting to see the host nation bid farewell, at least on the field, to its tournament. And went to this game. On the way to the media centre, I see this chap walk past in a Three Lions Pride T-shirt and a similar cap, a rainbow emblem on his cap, black cap. And I stopped him and I just had a chat. A chap called Anthony from London. I said, you know, I didn't think it'd be a news story. And it was a weird thing. I didn't ask for his second name or even his telephone number or whatever to see what was happening to him, because FIFA at that point had said rainbow flags and T-shirts were fine. You can go in. And they've been saying that. So I wished him all the best. Went to cover the game. Something else happened in that game, which we can discuss later about the crowd. And then I left the stadium and I just looked on Twitter. And Anthony, the person that I had seen a few hours earlier, had become a news story. The poor chap, he'd been strip searched on his way into that stadium. And according to his recollection or his evidence, his cap had been hidden while he was undergoing this strip search. And they said he hadn't bought one in, only when he challenged them and said, look, this country has more CCTV at the moment than any place on earth. Let's go and have a look at the video. This cap mysteriously reappeared and he went in. But again, this guy has to go through this for a reason that is very hard to know, given FIFA have given permission to fans to wear this, to wear Pride T-shirts. I really don't understand, Rob.
Although FIFA have still never actually issued a statement saying that there's been a renewed message to tell stadiums not to confiscate rainbow flags. We only actually know because the Football Association of Wales officially put out the response that they received from FIFA.
Yeah, but there's the other point with this is that I know that the seven FAs that involved in the initial armband protest that we were talking about last week have been in regular dialogue, almost daily dialogue, on behalf of their fans. And on a daily basis, they've been told that these things are allowed. And it isn't about Pride T-shirts, though. That's the thing. It's about like fans feeling safe and FIFA giving them their word. And then this type of thing happening as a result of it.
I'm actually quite surprised that the security guards are so sort of bothered about trying to stop people doing it. Why not just, you know, it's 4 weeks out of your a whole country's existence. Why not just like let people do it and then move on? Do you know what I mean? I'm really quite surprised that the hostility that people wearing rainbow hats or rainbow T-shirts have encountered.
My favourite moment of an item being removed was something that's familiar often at these events, taking a bottle of water into, not a stadium, but a FIFA-related venue. And when it's not a FIFA official branded bottle, they'll often take the label off. The problem with the label that the security were trying to take off was it had I Love Qatar on it from the local brand. So you had security removing I Love Qatar. And I did point out how sort of strange that was. They were destroying I Love Qatar.
No, I mean, there is a lot of, over the top security. But partly, I think, guys, it's to do with the fact that the security personnel are also terrified of losing their own jobs. They're not Qatari either. A lot of people I've seen are from Pakistan or from Jordan and other countries, and they're here, and this job is important to them. If they've been told this is what you have to do by someone higher up, that there's little flexibility. And you notice that in things like, you know, when there's these massive maze-like barriers, like you're in Disneyland or something to go into the station or something, and there's no one in it, they still make you do the entire journey, and everyone is following the rule, because if they let you off, you know, someone might be watching and then tell them off. So it just kind of perpetuates itself, the bizarreness of it all.
Yeah, I suppose there has been some of that sort of close dealing still. The fact had one moment when a couple of police came up when we were broadcasting outside a stadium and they just wanted to chat and they talked about their experiences doing some work in England building up to the tournament preparing. So perhaps we wouldn't expect of that, actually, that sort of level of engagement, because they might be wary of sort of media, particularly broadcasting in open places like they aren't used to.
But on the security, there's some other funny bits have happened. I bumped into some Belgian spotters in the Souk Waqif, the kind of cultural hub here where a lot of fans have been congregating. And I was chatting with them and I said, there aren't that many Belgian fans to actually spot. So these are like hooligan spotters. And I said, how many do you reckon there are? He said, probably not more than 300. So it's like at least one spotter for every 100 fans. So everyone's like gone through the process, haven't they? But it's just a funny experience.
What were you going to say about the fans at the Qatar's last game?
Yeah. So there's something I noticed at other games as well, but I didn't quite understand what was going on. So if you go to a lot of the group stage games, particularly involving, European nations that didn't bring many fans or some of the smaller countries, you'd be in a stadium and right up until about 15 minutes before kickoff, these beautiful, beautifully appointed stadiums, very well-designed stadiums, are sometimes half empty, three quarters full. And then you kind of look down at, you know, your laptop or something you're working, you look up and the stadium's suddenly full again. And you think, wow, there must be a lot of late arrivals here. But then at that Qatar versus Holland game, someone sent me a text to say that people with this hire card, which is effectively a visa, and even for residents here, you need to buy a ticket, you have to have this app, can just show up at the gate and they were let in free. So I thought I'd check that out. And this row behind me was like, yep, talked to a man. He said he'd just come in. He's got five family members. They were letting everybody in. And then I went just down to the concourse and there were hundreds of these laborers and they said they'd been bussed in. They said, one guy, so they all work for the same company. There was 20 coaches with 50 seats and his boss had made the arrangements the night before, but they brought them to the stadium and they couldn't get into the seats because too many of them had arrived. So they were just stuck. It was just all very random. And then I've talked to a Brazilian journalist who works in television, not a rights holder, so just outside the stadium, and he'd seen people rushing gates at three or four stadiums. And it's fine to fill these stadiums up because it's nice. It's better to have full stadiums than empty stadiums. But if you try and ask the organisers about this, and it's one of these questions that I've had in for about a week, just don't get a reply.
It's interesting that, Terry. I mean, I remember in the 2002 World Cup in South Korea, there was a sort of similar thing because there were quite a lot of matches that weren't sold out. And you would suddenly get groups of Korean fans supporting whoever was playing, and they were provided with actual shirts. So not just T-shirts, not the official sort of, you know, £100 replica strip. So if USA were playing, for example, they might all turn up in red T-shirts, and you'd have hundreds of these fans bust in, given free shirts, free tickets, or whatever. So yeah, they've probably learned from that experience.
Imagine trying to fill some of those games in 2026 when there's 48 teams and there's a load more games across some countries as well. It sort of shows the challenge. And as we look here to Qatar, you know, I've been at England game, Germany as well, and they have seemed pretty full, the stadiums, but obviously there are challenges filling the rest of the venues, and particularly as talk has turned to a potential Olympic bid, and the Olympics often does struggle in terms of incoming fans, don't they, in terms of how many want to travel all around the world to fill venues. And we saw it here for the World Athletics Championships in 2019, the challenge there, hugely empty stadiums. Now there is talk of this Olympic bid, which could be for 2036. They were overlooked for 2032 in favour of Australia, surely attention would focus on actually who would fill a lot of these venues there.
I was thinking about this before, whether Doha or Saudi Arabian City, because I think Saudi Arabia are also interested in bidding for 2036 Olympics, whether they'd actually be more suited to an Olympics and a World Cup. In some ways, yes. But they've always had a problem with the IOC, is that the IOC will not move the timing of the Olympics. And so they say it's got to be July, August. And I mean, that, I guess, would be unsustainable. Even if you air condition the streets, which they're talking about, can you see an Olympics happening that time of year?
I can't believe that we are now in the realms where we can talk about air conditioning streets, and it's just like something that we're just going to accept. Yeah, of course, you're just going to accept. We're just going to air condition the streets and have the Olympics. Yeah, 26 miles of the Olympic marathon air conditioned, like it's completely normal.
Well, I'm speaking to you actually from the waterfront where the marathon was run during the 2019 World Championships, and it had to be run around 2 a.m. because it was so hot around October time.
Yeah, I was there. Do you remember that, Rob? I mean, there were still people collapsing at that on that marathon. But it's just mad, isn't it, when we're talking about air conditioning, all of this stuff.
But it is fair to move the dates of the Olympics, though. I mean, actually, it shouldn't necessarily have to be held in June, July, August, that sort of time. Some countries couldn't have it because of the rainy seasons there.
Yeah, of course. But Martin's got an exact point there, though. It's slightly different to the FIFA World Cup, where these TV revenues come from all over the place. The Olympics is so heavily dependent on that deal with NBC in America. It's slightly less than it used to be, but it's still over 50% of its entire take comes from there. So they get to call the shots if they're putting the money in. So that makes me wonder, Ziggs, what if a country that doesn't really care about money says, we'll make up the difference?
Yes, well, that's a very good point, Tarek. And that's probably what will happen if it is to be successful. I mean, I do remember the late Mike Lee. He worked on an original bid by Doha for the Olympics, and they didn't even make the shortlist because they were kicked out. I remember him saying to me, "Yeah, one of these days the IOC is going to be faced with this issue that the Middle East wants to hold an Olympics, and the only way you can do it is by not playing it in having the Olympics in the summer. And somewhere, if it's Saudi Arabia, if it's Qatar, they have the money to make up that shortfall. If the NBC say they don't want to pay top dollar for an Olympics in November, December."
Of course, Saudi Arabia's got the 2029 Asian Winter Games, so maybe the Winter Olympics might come to the region far sooner, as we've discussed previously. But certainly Qatar, having built all these venues for the World Cup and the infrastructure, would, you'd think, want an Olympics not too far down the line, because we already saw with this World Cup that some of the infrastructure that was already here, like Khalifa Stadium, that was here for holding events in 2009, for instance, when England played Brazil in a football friendly here. Well, they had to rebuild that completely for the World Cup. So you don't have to go around another cycle of revamping stadiums to be updated with the latest technology repeatedly until you can actually get an Olympics.
Yeah, exactly. I just can't imagine them just keep building sporting venues. It's like it becomes a bit of an addiction. We haven't built a new stadium in a while. Let's bid for another event. They've got the Asian Football Championships as well next year, haven't they? Because China had to withdraw due to the COVID regulations there. So we're going to have another football tournament in Qatar in early 2023, I think. So at least it becomes a regional hub for these events.
Something to look forward to. And obviously, as the World Cup goes on, the European leagues are all on pause. But this has been a big week of news in European football because of what's been going on at Juventus. And it's been so busy. We've had the resignation of the entire board led by Andrea Agnelli, new details of indictments in terms of the criminal investigation into inflated transfers. Also, UEFA reopening a financial fair play case into Juventus and potentially ripping up the settlement they reached with them earlier in the year.
Yeah, I think they had to do that, UEFA, because, I mean, it looks very possible that the financial figures submitted by Juventus over several years may not be actually correct, because if this criminal investigation proves to be what's suspected proves to be true, then that would affect what Juventus have put forward to UEFA. They've just been fined for FFP breaches at the moment, but if they've sort of been found to not be truthful about what they put through, then that could be bans, whatever, couldn't it? I mean, Juventus, one of the Super League trio who keeping going, biggest club in Italian football. This is a complete meltdown.
But then you look at the counterparty and you think about the history of UEFA with big clubs and financial details and numbers perhaps not being quite what they are, and talking about massive investigations and huge repercussions, and it all ends up in a bit of a damp puddle and a slap on the wrist, really, doesn't it, historically? Maybe with Juventus being one of these Super League and European court opponents of UEFA, maybe they'll use that as an example. But again, I guess the jury's out when it comes to UEFA's disciplinary procedures.
They don't always choose to reopen cases based on new information.
Exactly, Rob. They don't. And you know, we're talking about you know, whether this whole financial fair play thing is heading into a new direction, whether it's going to be more transparent or not. I guess now is a test, and as you said, we just don't know when they want to take action and when they don't.
What about the downfall of Andrea Agnelli? A couple of years ago, he was still at the top of European football, chair of the European Club Association, leading Juventus. Now he's out as chairman of the club. Is this really the last we've heard of him relating to Juventus? Does it show the severity of the situation?
Probably, actually. I think it is, because he's presided over an absolutely terrible era in the club's history. And you're right, you know, even if UEFA don't do anything, I think there's a very strong chance the Italian authorities will have to take action. So I do think that. I don't see any way back from him. He was, in many ways, he sort of almost like triggered the Super League by coming on side when he was the president of the European Club Association. I think when he sort of turned on UEFA and decided to go with the Super League, that gave a lot of the rebels the sort of confidence that they could do this.
Mm-hmm. But in terms of who he is, I think we've got to put that into context a little bit as well. I mean, he is a member of the Agnelli family, that massive industrial family that owns Fiat, owns Ferrari, one of the most biggest industrial families in Italy, maybe the biggest. So it would be a huge, it's a huge downfall at the moment. And whether it's a test for the Italian judiciary as well, this taking on not just Juventus, that massively popular club, but also, I guess, a member of the Agnelli family. That said, there has been talk of there being tension in the family between John Elkann, his cousin who runs the Fiat business, and Agnelli, Andrea, with Juventus, whether there's this talk of a power struggle and having John Elkann wanting someone else to be in charge of Juventus. All of this is great fodder for the soap opera that is, I guess, sports news.
Yeah, the investigation relating to a couple of year period, 2018 to 20, the allegation is false accounting, and Agnelli and 11 other now former board members being pursued by prosecutors to go on trial. Juventus denying wrongdoing, saying the accounting treatment adopted in the contested financial statement falls within those allowed by applicable accounting principles. And they say that Juventus remains convinced that they've acted correctly. In unrelated football finance news, Martin, you've been going through the Arsenal accounts.
Yeah, quite interesting, actually. So Arsenal's annual figures have come out, and it shows that they completely different to all the other sort of big six clubs in the Premier League. Their wage bill has dropped to its lowest level since 2017. They obviously had a lot of big names off the payroll: Mesut Ozil, Aubameyang, and they've got a lot of young players coming in. But it's quite remarkable, I think, that in this day and age, that a club who is now top of the Premier League can actually have a negative wage growth. Whereas if you look at all the others, Tottenham Hotspur, theirs has been 61%. Manchester City, the other end, is 34%, and the other clubs somewhere in between. So Arsenal's is just 5.6% over the last 5 years. It's quite an intriguing thing. And I think they say it's part of a restructuring of the first team squad to provide greater efficiency, which I think means don't pay huge salaries to players who don't do very much towards the end of their careers.
Yeah, and they got caught up in that cycle with that clamour to renew stars, Ozil and Aubameyang, you mentioned. You remember as their contracts were running out, there's that clamour from the media and supporters that you better sign this guy. And as soon as they double their wages to this, God knows how many hundreds of thousands of pounds a week, the performance falls away. But on the other hand, Ziggs, this Arsenal team has, I think, been a revelation in the first half of the season, surprised people, got to the top of the league, and players and their agents, they won't say, guess what, you know, we're just happy to be at the top of the league and we'll take this little money that you're paying us. If they keep performing, guess where that pressure's going to arrive and guess where that wage bill's going?
Yeah, for sure. And I think the other thing to mention is that they weren't in Europe last season, so there were no European bonuses to pay, which would also have an effect on dampening down the wage bill.
Club matters starting to creep back into the news agenda, but still halfway through this World Cup, many Qatar issues still to occupy everyone's minds.
Well, it's been fascinating talking to you guys out there.
Yeah, I mean, it feels like we've been here so long. I feel a bit like Gianni. It feels like we've moved to Qatar.
Just without the Salt Bay.
Yes, without the gold leaf steak.
Well, thank you all for listening. As ever, you can message us at SportLots on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. But for now, goodbye.